It seems to be like a large, long package. And Flair has
been... Hey.
From the Mundangerous Chop Shop in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 116 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about how to change a character in the middle of a campaign without getting rid of them altogether. But first, the Rogue Traders set up the longest of cons in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign. And later, the Savage Sage puts city scholars to shame in the Character Creation Forge. It's a bit of a tongue twister to start us off.
Yeah, you started that one on hard mode.
All right, speaking of hard mode, our entire recording schedule for the month of November is totally cocked up because we got a lot of trips coming up, including one that you've got in the middle of the month and the middle of the country.
Yep, we're going to Dayton, Ohio on November 10th through 12th for Catacon. I have not submitted a game to run yet, and the schedule is filling up, so I don't know if I will be running a game, but I'll definitely be playing games, and if not, I'll probably just go in the, like, I need a GM pile. Like, rent a GM or whatever.
Very, the lowest of rates.
Right, exactly. Free! For 3 to 4 hours. For a system I may or may not have ever read.
All right, I think that's November 10th through 12th.
Correct.
The weekend after that, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, the 17th through the 19th, both of us will be in Philadelphia to look at the Liberty Bell and to trace Ben Franklin's footsteps. No, we're not doing any of that, actually.
No, we're just going to the inaugural edition of PAX Unplugged.
Oh, that sounds very interesting. Shane, what will we be doing there?
We will be hanging out and not participating in any panels because we were not asked to. And in fact, we're rejected when we asked to.
But you know what? That's fine, because we will be there with our entire gaming group, who I've been told to say are very cool people that we like a lot, who don't annoy us.
Correct. And because some of them may or may not have embarrassing information about us, we are required to continue repeating that. Send help.
You can't blink in Morse code on a podcast.
Right, yeah. Not a visual medium.
They said I should Twitch. Why didn't we Twitch? Right.
Speaking of sending help, there's a new Unearthed Arcana this week, and...
Oh
boy.
I'm actually very impressed with us, as I rarely am, because... We're basically recording this right after it came out, and which means you will be listening to this only the week after. Fiendish Options, which gives us a whole bunch more Tiefling subraces in addition to the Tiefling subrace that we got in Sword Coast Adventures Guide. So 5th edition is all Tieflinged up.
Yeah, and each of these are tied to a specific fiend, like sort of the fiend that is your ancestor. So it follows the similar mold where you get an ability score increase of 2 to charisma and then +1 to another stat. And then you get some spells. And the spells are flavored around who your bloodline is sired by.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, we know that this portion of a tiefling's stat block doesn't do all that much, right? You get... a cantrip, you get a like spell once you hit 3rd level that you can use once a day, and then a spell once you hit 5th level that you can use once a day. It's, you know, more flavor than anything else, really. But this does mean that tieflings are even more so the most flexible race in the game. Now, some people might say that this means that there's actually too much variation in tieflings, but it does harken a lot back to when they were introduced for Planescape in 2nd edition. And so, fingers crossed that this is another sign that maybe Planescape is coming down the pipe, because we're getting a lot of spells that have to do with planar creatures, and I don't know, tieflings are getting a whole bunch of love, so I guess we'll see.
Yeah, and I mean, Planescape Torment Remastered came out this year, so perhaps that sold well enough to generate some interest. I mean, Wizards of the Coast would never miss out on the gaming tie-in opportunity of a lifetime for Planescape, would they?
They're great with digital products.
Right. So the part of this that I was most excited about is actually more of the NPC-focused portion of the article, with Diabolical Cults. Basically, the idea that any powerful devil is going to want to attract a group of followers to do their bidding while they're trapped in the Nine Hells.
Yeah, each of the powerful fiends listed earlier in the document gets its own cult write-up, and it'll tell you what the typical cultist is like. It'll give you a few signature spells that most people in the cult can probably cast if they're spellcasters, and then it gives you one or two new abilities that you can insert into the stat block of an enemy that your party is facing. Some of these are really cool and flavorful, and some of them are really powerful.
Yeah, and I mean, I think these are a cool variety of turning, you know, just a normal human or whomever into something a little more dangerous and frightening for PCs.
I also love that if you strip away the flavor of them being fiendish at all, this gives you a nice bit of crunch that you can work with to slap onto other creatures, even if you're not dealing with a fiend, right? Like, the ability itself can just be reflavored and then used on enemies that you might be throwing at your party.
Yep.
We also get demonic boons.
Yeah, so demonic boons are specific gifts that are imbued by a devil to particularly loyal followers or whomever, maybe a cult leader, that type of thing.
These are totally not the flip side of blessings. Like, people might be like, oh, I have a warlock, or, you know, someone who's consorting with a fiend, and maybe my PC can get this boon. These are definitely not scaled to the right power level for PC use. Like, every single one offers a +4 bonus to an ability score.
Yeah, and I think the way that this is set up is that the devils are limited in how many targets they can have, like how many boons they can bestow. So I think, like, narratively, this is probably more of like a devil saying, you know, you're too weak to win this fight, here, have some help, versus the cult boon being more about like, I am a worshiper, therefore I become typical and I begin to like act like and gain the abilities of over time. Like, that's kind of me being twisted by the devil. This is sort of more, seems like more of a temporary thing. And these vary quite a bit. Some of them are like probably mechanically unrecognizable by PCs, like Fraz or Blue. Like, he gets advantage on wisdom checks and then can automatically see illusions as a bonus action, which would be awful hard for a player character to determine in the 6 to 8 rounds of combat.
Although if this was a recurring enemy who they were tracking, that might be something that could come out. Whereas others are extremely obvious in combat.
Baphomet or Baphomet, I don't know how to pronounce it, but either way is the hunter demon. And so as an action, once per short or long rest, he can allow his allies to attack his target as a bonus action, as long as they share the similar feature, unerring tracker. And it's like, cool, you're going to notice when all of a sudden, like, 4 people descend upon you and all at once stab you. Like,
yeah,
that's going to feel pretty demonic.
Yeah, and if you've got a Flind, right, a high-powered gnoll who's been blessed by Yunugu, just every single gnoll around them, because they all have the Rampage trait, can just, you know, make extra attacks as a bonus action. Because why not? Gnolls weren't scary enough as it was.
What's better than that, though, is that it grants the Rampage trait. So it's not just, like, a gnoll has it. Like, you could give this to a human, and then all the gnolls around him get better, too.
Or just rampaging humans, whatever.
Right. So one issue here is that they don't mention anything about CR. So for some of these that are less combat applicable, it's probably no adjustment. But, you know, the null thing, that could be a big change in challenge for a party. So I would hope that in any final published version that they would at least address that.
All right. Speaking of addressing potential issues, Shane, where are we in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign?
So the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign is our Warhammer 40K Rogue Trader game played using Dark Heresy 2nd Edition rules by Fantasy Flight Games. And the crew of the His Enduring Light are making their triumphant return to proper Rogue Traderly territory, Port Aquila, the last bastion before uncharted void space.
You know, this is basically the closest place to home that we have, except that we don't like to stay here a lot because every time we do stay here, there's a massacre that we accidentally cause.
Yeah, it's like home, except that some of you have never even been there before yet.
But it feels that way because we always regale them with stories.
Right. But it feels like a place where I would feel at home.
All right. So we have finally closed our first major trade deal on the garbage world of Gontalgrim. But there was a slight problem because our amazingly awesome psyker, who is the best psyker that any rogue trader could ever have, killed our rogue trader.
I think you're not supposed to say that either.
No.
Through a series of unfortunate, warpy events, Lord Captain Lionheart is indeed dead. Not directly through any of your hands, but through the misfortunate dealings of fate, let's say. He has died.
Directly through one of our brains, okay?
Okay, sure. If you insist. And that's going to be a problem for you. You don't want your warrant of trade to go to some other rogue trader who might require you to, you know, follow orders or risk your lives or just generally, you know, make life more difficult for any of you.
Oh, yeah. I hate all of those things.
You've kind of grown accustomed to your autonomy and your sort of small council running the void ship instead of taking orders again.
All right. So we have to come up with a plan to, I have no idea, replace the rogue trader, I guess?
Yeah, because he doesn't have a natural heir who would normally inherit it. So you don't know who it would go to.
Okay. What about an unnatural heir? Is his rogue traderly seed still harvestable?
I do not believe so.
What about cloning?
Not after 16 days.
Flying dead in bed?
Right.
We got a heretic who calls himself a doctor.
Yeah, I'm glad that you didn't pursue that approach because, man, that would have been a tragic end of the campaign when Nurgle or Slaanesh burst through the through the veil.
Oh, fair.
But, you know, you did argue over a lot of different options, and you weren't happy with any of them, I would say, but you did end up settling on a plan.
Ah, that's how you know it's a game run by Shane.
Right. So you intend to report Elias Lionheart, killed in action, noble death, and promote his heir, Silva Lionheart, into the title of Lord Captain, thus inheriting his warrant of trade.
Yes, his previously secret heir, Silva Lionheart, who was totally not made up, and who we now need to find.
And so you start looking around for an heir. And who do you find?
Look, I was absolutely correct. We have these two twins who are definitely magical.
So you promote one of the twins to Rogue Trader.
Yeah. Well, you know, Rogue Trader, for now, will run the ship until she gets older. Because she's a teenager.
Yeah, she's like 13, maybe 14. She's like a tween. I like this plan because you don't even know what her name is. Like her real name. And you've been calling her and her brother Topsy and Turvy. But you can't decide which one is Topsy and which one is Turvy. So you're not even really sure who it is that you're promoting as your rogue trader, but you're going to do it.
Yeah, she's Sylva Lionheart is who she is.
Yeah, and you will, you know, act on her authority and handle the affairs of the ship until she comes of age. Obviously, you're responsible rogue traderly crew.
Okay, good. So that's all taken care of. That will definitely not come back to bite us in the ass. We're good. What's next?
Well, you get to Port Aquila and have to pull off the ruse.
Well, that's fine, because now that we're at Port Aquila, we can do some shopping. And the very, very first thing we buy is a disguise kit.
Right. Get her nice and dressed up, parade her in public, never let her speak directly to anybody, and get her back on board the ship.
That's right. We're going to get her some big pauldrons. It's 40K, so she'll have like a giant collar.
Yep. definitely a sweet admiral's hat.
Yeah, with like a plucky feather.
And leather boots that go at least to the knee, but ideally probably a little bit past.
Well, she's only 13, so pretty much any normal size jacket will go past the knee.
Right. But there's a surprise waiting for you when you get to Port Aquila, isn't there?
Well, not for all of us, just for Flair, our psyker.
Yeah, he has a package waiting for him.
Which is weird, because we don't really get mail out here on the edge of civilized space.
Yeah, and it's even more bizarre. It's inscribed with the sigil of his astropathic house. Remember, yeah. He's actually like mutant psyker nobility, even though he's kind of the black sheep of his family. So Flair has been petitioning his house consistently for years, begging them for a force sword, which is a sort of psychically active weapon that he can channel his psychic energy into in order to do a ton of damage.
Yeah, it's like a high-end artifact, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, it's a type of thing where, like, Force swords have names, and Flair does not have a name.
So we're all really kind of amazed that his family finally was like, all right, yeah, you get a Force sword. It's like, hey, kind of crappy paladin, here's your Holy Avenger.
Right. So he pays an exorbitant fee to the courier, if you recall, who's been waiting there for 8 months. And apparently was not staying on the cheap while he was there. And he starts, you know, pulling open eagerly the box. And what's inside, Ishan?
It's a force staff.
Okay, so not quite a force sword, but still pretty cool, right?
Yeah, pretty great. It's like a second tier artifact.
Right, it's a two-handed force sword. At any rate, I mean, let's be fair. Flair is pretty ecstatic, right? And I mean, so is Angelo. And this is what Angelo paid for, right? This is he paid profit factor to recruit this gear.
Right, like you know, above the table, out of character, we were like, sorry, we can't afford a force sword.
Exactly. So he gets the next best thing, and he basically has his endgame weapon. And then along with that, you guys start, you know, spending your time with black market arms dealers and the like, and, you know, getting off some, or picking up some off the books imperial weapons, some, you know, some Xenos artifacts, maybe, you know, getting all the cool, like, 40K iconic gear. Finally, you're going to be real rogue traders and you're going to look the part.
Yeah, so exciting. Power sword, we get a refractor field. A couple of us get refractor fields. Trank, who is a very good shot, decides to pick up a Kroot pulse rifle, which, out of character, I have to give a shout out to the All Guardsmen party, because they made excellent use of pulse weapons in that write-up. Which is sort of what put me on the track of looking for what pulse weapons might actually be doing. And they're really good in Dark Heresy 2nd Edition.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got some endgame gear too. But as always, the galaxy is dark and grim, and even endgame weapons will not protect you from what comes next.
An 8-year time skip.
So the crew stumbles upon a damaged void ship caught on a warp reef deep within the Empyrean. They are intrigued by it, but unsure how to proceed, and they eventually determine that they're going to board it and see what's up. But first, what have they been up to in the intervening years?
We'll find out next week. So this week, we're talking about respecking. Now, this is a term from MMO, like video games. Originally, I believe it actually means re-specification.
Re-specializing?
Something like that. I don't really know. It's changing the mechanical representation of a character, right? The quote-unquote build of a character while it's still in play. So in a lot of video games, or later iterations of video games, you had the option to redistribute your skill points or change your stat spread or make different class feature choices. In tabletop RPGs, however, it sounds pretty like gamey or gamist to talk about your character's build, right? Especially when you're, you know, role-playing at the table. But respecking a PC, or if you're the GM, allowing one of your players to respec their PC can be a really great way to make sure that a character stays in the game when there might not really be any other way to keep them in the campaign, when it might make sense otherwise for them to leave.
Okay, so why do respecking at all?
Well, I think the most common reason is that a player is bored with the mechanics of their character. Now, it's happened to all of us. It happens to some people more often than others, but every single one of us has at some point gotten bored with playing a particular character, even if you actually really like the backstory or the personality that you've come up with.
Yeah, I thought playing a diviner was going to be so great.
But it turns out I just always know what's going to happen.
Yeah, and I don't have any big spells to blow things up with.
Yeah, like, oh, I never played a rogue. I thought it would be awesome to play a rogue. But I hate hiding. I really prefer to just charge things. This is getting kind of boring.
Or like a lot of times new players start with fighter and find out that fighter doesn't offer you a lot of variety, and that after you get the mechanics of the game under your belt, like maybe you want to try wizard.
Yeah. Maybe you're like, you know, 5 weeks in and you're like, all right, I get the swinging a sword thing. Now I want to try some of these awesome spells.
No, sorry. You're playing that character until you hit level 20 in 2 years.
Yep. You suck forever. Something I think a lot of new players really like is the fire mage, right? Oh, it's a pyromancer. I'm totally going to play that. And then it turns out that a bunch of enemies are immune or resistant to fire.
Mm-hmm. And also, like, you're a very blunt weapon, right? Like, all you can really do is light things on fire.
Yeah.
So what are some options here?
Well, I mean, sort of the old school way of thinking about it is you could kill off the character, right? Okay, I don't like playing my fighter. All I need to do is run headlong into combat, get skewered, and then I can just roll up a new character, right? That's fun.
Yeah. Here lies character number one. He died a pointless death.
I guess if you're not that like bloodthirsty, or you don't want to like see your character get cut up into little bits, you could have them retire, become an NPC, or, you know, I've seen characters just sort of wander off, right? Like, oh, they don't see a reason to continue with the party, so they just walk off into the forest and we don't see them again.
Yeah, sure. And all those work, right? I mean, they're tropey for a reason, but sometimes you just like love the character and like the backstory, or like you like the arc that the character is on, but you just are tired of the mechanics of the character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what if, you know, you've taken all the advice that you've seen in the DMG, and you've done a great job of integrating the entire party, and everyone is like connected to two other party members, and we've got this shared backstory, and we have these common goals. Well, okay, if your fighter walks off, now all of that begins to unravel. If you're a GM, what if you worked with this player for 3 weeks on a freaking backstory that you have, you know, worked into the plot? It's become an integral part of the plot, and now they love that, but they think this character playing it is actually boring.
Yeah, so respecking gives you the opportunity to retain the character in the story, but give the player different mechanics to experiment with. And these are kind of, you know, incremental changes or complete overhauls. So maybe your rogue now becomes a monk.
Yeah, maybe that fire mage swaps out a few spells, even if the rules don't say that you can right now.
yeah, it's an easy switch to go from barbarian to fighter or barbarian to paladin, right?
Right. The key is that the personality of the character, the history of the character doesn't change. All you're doing is changing what's under the hood and probably not even talking about it that much in game.
Yeah, this also gives an opportunity to players to use new options. So, you know, a single campaign of D&D can last for years or decades, apparently. But additions change, new books come out, you know, options for players continue to evolve. And like, if you start your character on day one, maybe that isn't as exciting for you anymore because other cool options have come out that you didn't get a chance to play with a year later.
Yeah, maybe you love playing your fighter, but the feat that you took at fourth level, actually there's a much better one that came out 3 years later. It kind of sucks that you've got to wait, you know, 8 months until you get another feat and have to stick with something that like just doesn't fit your character as well. I mean, think about in our very first episode, we built a swashbuckler before the Sword Coast Adventures Guide swashbuckler existed. So imagine if you're playing that character, right? Like all multi-classed up, which, you know, would be fun because that's the reason we built it in the first place. But then Sword Coast Adventures Guide comes out and you're like, well, this does it better and it's not a hack to make a character that I wanted in the first place. Instead of being like fighter one, rogue six, barbarian two, can I just be like a all swashbuckler?
Right. Also, you can run into situations where new options just like make old options obsolete. So think of the revised ranger, which we're about 95% sure will be coming in Xanathar's guide.
No, it's definitely not coming in Xanathar's.
Oh, it's not?
No, they said it's because they want to release it for free somewhere, so you don't have to pay for it.
Oh, okay. Well, it's probably coming around the same time as Xanathar's guide. Or the Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide has the Gish cantrips for wizards and sorcerers. Like, if you have already taken your cantrips for your character, you might not have a chance to learn one of those.
Yeah, it's sort of weird for us to be like, what if someone doesn't want to multi-class and get new cantrips? You know, it's a long time before you learn new cantrips in a lot of classes.
And then, of course, like, it can just be fun to try new things. Like, there's no reason to justify beyond that. It's just like, you know what? Sometimes I want to do something different, and I think that would be fun. And, like, I'm at that point now.
Yeah, I think about in a superhero game, a new book comes out, it might have new, really cool superpowers in it. So, like, everyone wants to try those things without actually having to start an entirely new campaign. You might also respec a character because it mirrors a change that happens in the story. So in the Morning Glory campaign, Kallik started off as a vengeance paladin because he was trying to avenge the loss of Seer. But then, you know, maybe I think 14 levels in, he meets his daughter, he retrieves his wife's sword. Like, vengeance didn't make sense for him anymore. So Jim and I talked, and he ended up respecking from Oath of Vengeance to Oath of Devotion, which fit the new outlook that his character had much better than his old build.
You also might have characters who become more devout as they level and progress through the story. So they have an actual like religious conversion. You might go from, say, fighter into cleric or fighter into paladin.
Yeah, and if you think about it, the way that a character's abilities are expressed in the game, you could say, all right, I'm a fighter 5, and then I level up and I become fighter 5, cleric 1. But if in the game the character was imbued with holy power, with like a flash of, you know, divine light, it's sort of weird to be like, oh, he's still an amazing fighter, and now, you know, he can cast 2 level 1 spells per day. And like, how does that reflect, you know, the being imbued with holy might? It doesn't really.
Yeah.
But it does make sense if you become a 6th level cleric, or especially a war cleric.
Yeah, and I mean, D&D kind of already has a tradition of some of this stuff. Like, the Paladin's Fall in prior editions, you would go from Paladin to Fighter based on in-game reasons. In 3rd edition, you could also go into Blackguard as the prestige class. And even now in 5th edition, we have the Oathbreaker, who is an option for a fallen paladin.
Yeah, the fallen paladin turning into a fighter, like just using all, losing all their abilities, is very much an example of a forced respecking that I think both of us are... don't think is typically a good idea. But I did love in 3rd edition how the stronger a paladin you were, the better a blackguard you became, because you would just cash in those levels.
Mm-hmm. Other settings have similar situations that make sense, like a Jedi who falls to the dark side, you'd probably just want to rebuild as a Sith.
Yeah, and you certainly want to learn Force Lightning.
I mean, obviously.
And of course, if you swing, if you start as a Sith and then, you know, become redeemed, you're going to need to get rid of Force Lightning.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I know.
Take the good with the bad, I guess. I mean, at the very least, even if the edition you're playing doesn't require you to rebuild, you would at least want to start swapping out powers and that sort of thing.
You can also have time pass in your game. There could be a full-on time skip, you know, let's move ahead 5 years in the game. But it could just be, you know, we've skipped ahead a season. And some abilities get rusty. Like in real life, abilities get rusty if you don't use them all the time. Or if a character is focused on learning a new ability, they may just sort of forget old ones. And that's much better reflected by respecking or trading in a few levels here and there, or a few abilities, or moving around some points, rather than simply adding on new ones. Because in order to get a bunch of new abilities in most games, you need to become much more powerful. You need to gain a bunch more XP or get a whole lot of more character creation points. Respecking lets you change much more fundamentally without necessarily drastically increasing the power level of your campaign.
Yeah. So what are some considerations for GMs as they're looking at respecking for their players?
I think there are two main considerations. The first is the continuity of the story, and the second is player enjoyment. So if respecking is the easiest or the fastest or the most convenient way to make your player happy, I would say in general, go ahead and allow it.
Unless that respecking is turning your player's character in from a two-armed character into a one-armed character, Ishin.
Look. I was just letting you sweat it for a while, knowing that you guys probably weren't going to get into that much combat, and I was going to fix it. Well, you were going to have the opportunity to fix it. And even if you didn't fix it by taking the devil's bargain, the angels were going to fix it.
Right.
But yeah, in general, you don't want to force a respec on a character. Just like a fallen paladin, but also, you know, if someone has gotten used to playing a particular set of abilities, and, you know, like to them, this sheet, that is your character, right? As a GM, you don't usually want to go around saying, well, I'm moving some stuff around, you know, unless you are adding to it. Hey, here's a divine boon or something like that.
Right. I think it's also fine to place blanket restrictions on respecking just for the sake of the story or for ease of play. If you declare that stuff up front, right? So we're playing a 5th edition reworking of Birthright, and Jim, our DM, was like, look, you're going to pick your class now because too much is tied to that. And if you want to change your subclass when Xanathar's comes out in November, that's fine. But we aren't going to try and like rework your whole background and all of your holdings and all of the different things that go into your character, because class is too central to the system.
Right. So he didn't say no respecking allowed, right? He said, just don't change your class. And we'll talk about subclasses once Xanathar's gets here, because he knows, like, we're all going to look at that book and be like, oh man, new stuff. This is awesome. I want to use this.
Yeah. And also, we'll talk about Birthright in probably a few weeks as well.
So when you are allowing your players to respec, there are essentially two kinds. There's the limited respec and the full respec. The limited lets them change their character within certain boundaries. So Jim, for example, says, make sure you keep the same class. Often when you're presenting a limited respec, you want them to keep the things that are obvious in the game and that will be obvious to the other characters in the game. So you usually want to maintain your race and then probably like your main stat or your primary skills, because, you know, characters are going to notice, or it's sort of a little difficult to explain why the party face is no longer talking anymore and like how they suddenly got ugly.
Yeah, or how the rogue is now suddenly in shining paladin's armor.
Right, and like very loud.
Yeah, this is basically the under the hood method, right? Like, keep the car looking shiny, but whatever you do under the hood, that's up to you.
Yeah, exactly. If you're going rogue to monk, it makes sense that there's a rogue and they become a shadow monk and now they can teleport in shadows, but maybe that's just reflavored as being super ultra stealthy.
Right. Or like a soldier to an outlaw, or a sniper to a gunslinger kind of archetype.
Doing this is pretty easy to explain in game, or, you know, if it's just small little things, you don't even really need to explain it in the game at all. Like, characters don't have any concept of classes or how certain abilities are siloed within classes, right? Like, other characters in the game aren't going to point at the barbarian and say, wait a minute, you can't action surge, because they don't know what the hell an action surge is.
Right. So the alternative, then, is a full respec. This is pretty much no holds barred.
Yeah, and I would say don't ever let your players do this, because it's more trouble than it's worth, and really it only results in garbage characters. Right, Shane?
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, you are alluding to our Morning Glory campaign, our Eberron game that we recapped for the first 70 episodes of the show.
And the fact that Shane's character, Brand, went from being a human cleric to a half-elf sorcerer.
With a few multi-classes.
But stayed the same guy.
Right.
Right. You can actually read up on all of the conversations that went on behind the scenes. If you go to our Patreon, it is a post that anyone can read, even if you're not a supporter.
Yeah, you gave us the option of either retiring our characters or bringing in a new one to the Morning Glory campaign, but encouraged us to respec, because that allowed us to keep the same storyline intact. And this was all centered around starting with the D&D Next playtest and then the PHB coming out. So, you know, we were finally getting the final rules of the game. We wanted to make sure that we followed those.
Right. I mean, knowing that lots of things would change since the entire thing was a playtest. Since the entire thing had started as a playtest, it made sense to not lock people into something that might turn out to be something that they didn't really want to play. Now, everyone else kept the same... Well, so everyone kept the same character. Everyone else kept the same build, essentially just switched it over to the final PHB version.
Uh-huh.
But Shane decided that he wanted to play an entirely different class.
Uh-huh.
But that was because you were getting bored of cleric, right?
Yeah, I didn't like
Wasn't
cleric.
Wasn't that it? Yeah.
So that was my main complaint, was I didn't enjoy the mechanics of my class, and I didn't want to stick around for the PHB version, which was moderately different, so I didn't.
Yeah, we were having conversations about how I liked how Brand had fit into the party, into the storyline, and then also the party as like a team member. But obviously, you know, if Shane wasn't happy playing a cleric, I didn't want him stuck doing that for 12 more levels until the campaign finished.
Yeah, and so I think had we had multiple characters wanting to respec, right, we would have been some type of campaign level event that granted that, right? That we walked in and then something changed us.
Right. Since we were playing Eberron, it probably would have been some sort of magical cataclysm, or I would have sent you on a quest to invade Necromancer's domain, or like an artificer's hideout, and then there would have been some massive explosion or something along those lines.
Or just like a lousy trip through the Mornland.
You were going to end up there eventually anyway.
instead, because it was really just me who was changing significantly, we came up with an insane cockamamie in-game reason for the change, which was basically Brand walked in a portal as one way as a human cleric and came out the other side as a half-elf sorcerer and was the exact same guy.
Yes, the human cleric who walked in a portal and came out a sorcerer.
And was just as confused as everyone else.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So we worked it into the story. Everyone else was, who is this guy? And then you needed to take a little bit of time to explain that, to prove that you were actually you. Although it was helpful that you had Cube with you who can basically read your mind and vouch for you.
Yeah, and I mean, as soon as I opened my mouth condescendingly, I doubt there was any question remaining.
It's very true. Also, some other people had problems in that portal as well. It just didn't change who they were fundamentally.
Right.
So another option for this full respecking is in the early parts of any campaign, just let the characters be kind of malleable. Like, if you think about it, everyone's still sort of figuring out their personality anyway, right? You know, like, you write your backstory and you're like, oh, I'm the brooding lone wolf and I don't really trust anyone and I'm the go-to guy for stealth. And then as soon as you get into the party, you're chatty all the time and you like to talk to all the NPCs. It just doesn't end up fitting the backstory. And so you just change the backstory or let the character become who they actually are rather than who you had arbitrarily decided they were going to be in the first place.
Right. So it's helpful to just not set characters in stone at any point in those first few sessions. I think Adventurers League allows you to respec up to level 5.
Yeah, I think they let you do it pretty much every session. You can actually change literally everything about your character except I think it's race. Maybe you have to keep the same race.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know who's doing the accounting on this. I feel like you could just change your character after every session anyway, but whatever, Adventurers League.
Yeah, I'd say in like a home game, that's probably going too far, but I don't see an issue with, certainly in the first few sessions at least, having people be like, oh, actually, I decided I want to go with a different subclass, or I want to put more points in this skill because it turns out someone didn't have that, and I find that fun.
Right.
So if you're a player who's respecking, number one, don't take advantage of a lenient GM, because respecking is pretty abusable if you try hard enough.
And also, like, it's annoying for other players at the table to constantly have like a member of the party changing and have to pretend, like, continue pretending that this is normal. So I would try and just limit it to like maybe once per campaign you do, you know, a big respec and then settle into it. And if you're really miserable, go back.
Yeah. So a few steps. First off, obviously, get permission. And then before you go about rewriting your entire character, figure out what it is that you don't like about your current character, or, you know, what is it that's not working? And then find out how you can change the least amount about your character in order to fix it.
Yeah, and then also look around at the other players at the table and solicit their input, or at least consider how they feel, because, you know, you're part of a team. So figure out if you switch roles, like, what skills or what abilities are you leaving empty? What gaps are you now creating? And then as you choose where you're changing into, like what your new class or new character will be, you don't want to step on the other PC's toes, because nothing will drive a player like insane faster than being the group's cleric and then the fighter became a cleric because I was having too much fun, I guess. I don't know. That sucks.
Yeah, like, if there's already an archer in the party, that's already so niche. Don't also become an archer. That just sucks for both of you.
Unless he's like, great, archer bros, let's do it. Like, that's fine. He's bought in.
Or they can be like, oh, wait, I don't have to arch anymore.
Yeah, BRB.
Perfect.
The former archer. The Sterling archer, if you will.
So when you do actually respec, be proactive about providing an explanation for what's different about you in-game. So, you know, the GM has the final say about what actually is canon, but offer options for why your character is different, you know? I trained in a new thing. I met a new person and found this out. I have dragon heritage or whatever, you know, give a bunch of options so that your GM doesn't have to come up with it all on their own and then like run one past you and you're like, I don't really like it, and then run another past you.
Yep. There's a couple ways to think about that. One is just to hand wave the in-game explanation.
Yeah, Kallax started off as a fire mage, I think up to like level 5, and then was like, I don't love this, I'm gonna be the same guy, but I think I want to be a paladin. Paladin seems really cool. And so everyone just sort of pretended that he had always been a paladin.
And then the contrast there is, right, integrating it into the story. So is there some event in-game that occurs? Are there repercussions of that happening? Yeah, I mean, this is Brand, right? Yes, there are repercussions. We figured it out.
Yeah. I actually also, I forgot that Angela's character, Bahar, had started out as a half-orc of House Thrashk and ended up as a half elf of House Medani, but was the same character. And we were just like, we'll just pretend that that was always like that.
Sure. It's a light retcon.
Yeah, why not?
So respecking as a player is not without pitfalls. The main thing is losing continuity, right? Other players are going to struggle to piece this together so that it isn't a huge interruption.
Yeah, this happened in Angela's 4E game with a character that I was playing, Locke, and that was actually just using the normal 4th edition retraining rules, because every single level you could, by the rules, change a thing about your character. And you know, 4E has 30 levels, so we're leveling relatively often, and every time that happened, it'd be like, oh, Locke has a different ability? I was like, well, yeah, I retrained.
Yeah, you also did that with magic items in 4th edition too, because you like would disenchant them and then re-enchant new weapons.
Yeah, you didn't like lose any gold, so actually if you could cast those rituals, you could actually just have totally new gear like every other day. Another big problem that some gaming groups run into is favoritism. So if you allow some players to respec, but others not to. And if you are going to do that, you need to consider why you're okay with some doing it and others not, and then helping the ones who you are saying can't do it to get to the point where you will allow it. Because it really sucks to stand there and watch someone else be able to change things about their character while you can't.
Yeah, I mean, I think the clear exception here is when it seems like a player is trying to abuse it. Obviously you want to keep an eye on that. If that's going on, that's probably a different conversation you need to have with the player. But in general, like, I think most GMs are hesitant if they aren't really bought into the change and the justification and what it will do to the story. So I think you really want to work with your player in that regard and make sure you can find some common ground, because it does suck that your reason isn't good enough is the reason you can't respec.
Yeah. And also, if you are the player who knows that you get bored with characters every 3 to 4 levels or so, like, just stick with it.
See what happens.
It can also be difficult to respec if you or if the GM or the player is overly wedded to the flavor of abilities or classes rather than just the mechanics. Because most of the reason that you're trying to respec in the first place is to change up the mechanics without changing the flavor. So just make sure that you're divorcing them properly in your head.
So I think to kind of conclude this, right, I think we're both in favor of allowing respecing in most situations at the table, but I just want to make sure that it doesn't become a distraction or a hindrance to the campaign or to the other players role-playing or to the overall narrative that we're building together.
Well said.
Do you hear that, Ishan?
I'm just erasing my character sheet, the whole thing. I'm erasing the entire thing and starting over.
Well, then you've got room for another character from the Character Creation Forge. But before we get to that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's Melis minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrillCast.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill. So this week on the Character Creation Forge, we're building the Savage Sage. Now, the Barbarian has this reputation for not being very skillful. I mean, even the skills that the Barb gets, right? Like, oh, animal handling and nature, they don't have the mental stats to really be good at them.
Yeah, so like every Barb has athletics and then some other useless crap.
Right. Fingers crossed that there's an endurance skill in this game.
Right. Or maybe I'll have high enough dex to occasionally pass a stealth check.
Maybe. Barbarians also don't really mesh well with spellcasters because you can't cast spells or maintain concentration while you're raging. But passive abilities that you get from other classes still work even while you're raging. And if you think about it, you're only really raging a few minutes out of every day.
So, what's the build for the Savage Sage?
Totem Barbarian 14, Pact of the Tome, Great Old One Warlock 5, Knowledge Cleric 1.
All right, I want to start from the Knowledge Cleric because Sage is where the title comes from. So, we are getting, of course, the two expertises in history type skills. So, either history, arcana, nature, or religion. We'll get double proficiency on two of those, which is just an amazing boon for any character. And then to add in first level cleric spells and some useful cantrips as well, like, you're getting a pretty good bundle of abilities for one level dip.
Yeah, guidance. I mean, guidance alone for like a sage based character is amazing.
Yeah, you also get like bless and some of the more utility cleric spells as well at first level.
Also, you're going to be able to use that Cure Wounds if you really need to, like twice per short rest.
Right.
So from Barbarian, you've got 5 rages a day. And while you're raging, you're getting +3 to damage. You've got Reckless Attack for advantage, extra attack, so you can attack twice. And Brutal Critical is adding 2 extra dice on all of your crits, which you're going to have quite a bit more of them with Reckless Attack.
You're also pretty tanky because you get damage resistance while raging, Danger Sense, which gives you advantage on dex saves, advantage on initiative, as well as relentless rage,
which is going to keep you up as long as you can make that constitution saving throw. And remember, you've got proficiency in constitution saves. I think a lot of people also forget that totem barbarians get a nice group of rituals. They're sort of ignored, but for a sage type character, you've got speak with animals, beast sense, and eventually commune with nature. And of course, if you're a totem barbarian, we're probably going bear at 3rd level. At 6th level, you could take Tiger, which will give you 2 more skills. I also really like Eagle, which lets you see things clearly a mile away.
And then from Warlock, we gain Telepathy. We take Pact of the Tome, so we get Ritual Casting and get to learn ritual spells that way, which obviously you'll never be casting a ritual spell while you're raging, so there's no conflict there.
You also get 3 invocations. Obviously, one of them is going to be Book of Ancient Secrets. I really like Eyes of the Runekeeper, which lets you read any writing. I like the idea of a barbarian who can just understand any sort of runes or really, you know, Latin, whatever.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yes, of course I can read that.
You would clearly become your tribe's farseer, right?
Literally, especially if you take the eagle eyes and you can read writing from a mile away.
Right. you also get Eldritch Sight or Devil's Sight.
And with Eldritch Blast, you've actually got a respectable ranged attack when you're not raging, which is pretty tough for a barbarian to come by.
Right.
So Shane, who is your Savage Sage?
So my Savage Sage is indeed a barbarian tribe's farseer, or at least in training to become their farseer. This is a tribe that doesn't really understand magic and doesn't really understand how these things work, and so has an ability at a young age and is being groomed to take over that kind of respectable elderly position until it is discovered that he can read.
Uh-oh.
He has taken to a dark pact, possibly the one that all farseers from his tribe end up making, right? And by learning Eyes of the Runekeeper and being able to read and being the only member of the tribe who can, is excommunicated as not quite, you know, a witch, but something of that sort. And then just has to kind of find his way in the world as part barbarian, part warlock, not really sure what's going on, but fascinated by this curse that has granted him access to knowledge that isn't passed down through oral tradition alone.
I love the idea that, you know, in fifth edition, all characters are naturally literate, but I love the idea that your barbarian was not literate, and it is the invocation that gives them the ability to read anything.
Right, right. And then, you know, it's kind of the character is always just excited to learn, right? It's sort of a fish out of water story, but the classes sort of reflect that pursuit of knowledge as well as their natural inkling of how to handle problems, which is, of course, to get angry and smash it.
And then maybe contemplate it afterwards.
Exactly.
Yeah, I like the barbarian smashes things, kills the enemies, and then loots the library.
Right. It's like the murders in the Rue Morgue all over again.
Where do you think I got the idea? It's a classic.
All right. So what's your character idea?
My Savage Sage is a diplomat. And part of the reason that she spends most of her time in civilized lands is to show up these cosmopolitan elitists who live in these large castles. They've always looked down upon her people, but of course she understands much more than they think she knows. And not just tribal wisdom, right, which sort of comes from Totem Barbarian, but she is an astrologer, you know, studies the stars and studies the strange entities that live even beyond the stars. And so, you know, her pact is with some vestige, one of the great old ones. It allows her to speak directly into people's minds. It gives her understanding of magic in a way that not even the court mages are able to. I like that the expression of ritual caster, like the best ritual caster in 5e is the Pact of the Tome Warlock, not someone who takes ritual caster, not a wizard.
Yeah, yeah. You got to cheat to get ahead.
Yeah. And, you know, here in the city, there is a very structured idea of what religion is, but she knows that the lines are very blurry between a god and a vestige and nature, right? So while she is mechanically knowledge cleric one, she doesn't really worship any particular deity. It's just sort of all wrapped up in her pursuit of knowledge from anywhere that it comes from. She doesn't believe in the idea of forbidden knowledge.
Yeah, yeah. I like that.
Also makes her a great teacher.
Yeah, it'd be a good NPC as well.
Yeah, I mean, maybe with a demonic boon from a cult.
Right.
Can see through every illusion.
Right.
Plus four to intelligence. Huh.
Now, how do you pronounce that again?
Look, I can only read it. I can't read it out loud.
Right. All right. Before we wrap up, I want to take a moment and thank all of our Patreon supporters.
Your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
And since we have hit the $200 level on our monthly contribution, we are working on the Character Creation Forge Codex. We've got some partners who are going to be helping us out to populate that for us, and then we will be releasing that as soon as we have stuff to release to Patreon, and we'll figure out how we'll be releasing it just publicly sort of after we've got everything compiled.
Okay. You can also leave us a review on iTunes. We currently have 69 of them.
Nice.
But, you know, but if you'd like to, you know, mess that up for us, we would love it, actually. And here is one from Anthony A123. Naturally clever, relatable, ingenuitive, terrific podcast. I love this podcast. It is a hard recommendation for old and new tabletop gamers, whether you're a player character, DM, or both. The topics are a source of knowledge that anyone can appreciate and apply to their own gaming experiences. The hosts have amazing chemistry, and yes, this is said in every entry, but it's true, and they really are responsive and helpful on Twitter. I cannot recommend them enough. The only request I have is for the character creation forge. Ishin has referenced anime multiple times on the show, and since we already have had Soups in the character creation forge, I feel it's about time an anime character is created. How about it? Anyway, it's an amazing listen that you will not regret. I second that.
Do you think Soups is a reference to Superman, or do you think it's just a reference to superheroes in general?
I think it's superheroes in general, because we've been holding Superman in reserve until after Xanathar's.
Oh, right.
I'm definitely into building an anime character. The problem is they're also typically so overpowered that it's basically just a wizard.
Yeah, and the other problem is that a lot of times I choose the character creation forge topic and I have absolutely no interest or understanding about it, so it's just unfortunate that the person in control is the one least enticed by anime characters.
Well, we've done a few video game characters and I don't know anything about those.
Well, once again, I picked them.
Well, here, I built a couple of the video game ones when you told me what they do. I'll just tell you what the anime character does and you just make it.
Okay, you send me that Blue Eyes White Dragon.
I think I understand that reference.
Did I Vegeta right?
Nobody Vegeta's right.
Did I Sailor Goku? So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We are talking about your RPG horror stories. So this is your last chance to send them on in.
And in the character creation forge?
We're building the Headless Horseman.
It's like it's Halloween or something around here.
Eh.
That's it for episode 116 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishin. Thanks for listening. Caw.
All right.
May. Quick, close the episode. Close the episode. We'll finish this up in, I don't know, 6 or 7 episodes, I guess.
Right. So in addition to finishing your Super Saiyan.
It's called a Kamehameha.
Okay. That's your word.